This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. During his time in office, Jim Douglas went to a lot of ribbon-cutting ceremonies, probably triple digits. And not just ribbons. He cut a vine at a vegetable farm. A couple of times at banks, the ribbon was made of dollar bills taped together. At the opening of a new birthing center at a local hospital, the ribbon was shaped to look like a large umbilical cord. Twice he was asked to turn on a light instead, and once he got to push the buttons to demolish the Crown Point Bridge. There was a saying, widely known around the state, that Jim Douglas would show up at the opening of an envelope. He's heard that joke, and to be honest, he embraces it. He showed up at these opening ceremonies, at parades, at fairs, at funerals, and at pancake breakfasts, because that's where Vermonters are. "I always knew," he says, "that I had a better sense of the aspirations, priorities, hopes, and dreams of the people of our state than anyone else." As for the nickname Governor Scissorhands, well, he doesn't like that one so much. Jim Douglas shares those reflections in his hot-off-the-presses autobiography, The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. Jim Douglas joins us today to reflect on a life in Vermont politics. Governor Douglas, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You got started early. In 1964, you started canvassing for Barry Goldwater, who was running for president. And you yourself actually ran that year for ninth grade class president, and neither of you became president. But that didn't dampen your enthusiasm for politics. And less than a decade later, you were seated in the Vermont State House as a very young representative. So what got you interested in politics?
Well, a lot of people wonder if I have it in my blood, but I don't. No one in my family was in elective office. My dad was the vice chairman of the Republican Town Committee, but not much more than that. I guess I started to listen and learn and become interested in the affairs of government at all levels, and that obviously is something that I pursued, as you indicated. Perhaps I was a little starstruck in 1964. I vividly remember some candidates for state representative coming into GOP headquarters, and I was thinking, wow, these are really big shots, and how could I have imagined that just 8 years later I'd be one of them myself?
What issues motivated you in those early years? Were they particular issues, or was it just a sense of civic duty and civic desire?
Well, in my early years in high school and as I came to Middlebury College, I think it was more civic duty. But as I became more familiar with the issues confronting Vermonters and developed an interest in running for the legislature in 1972, I became aware of and concerned about some of the issues that we're still confronting today. The district was geographically larger than it is now in Middlebury, and we had a number of farmers, and I remember talking with them about the cost of doing business, about the property taxes that they were finding onerous. I remember talking with merchants. I remember talking with school officials at that time. And even though it wasn't local, I recall even more than four decades ago, a lot of talk about our competitiveness, particularly with respect to New Hampshire. So as I became more aware of the issues confronting Vermont, I became interested in being a part of addressing them.
Why Vermont, though, and why not go home to Massachusetts where you were born and lived until you went to Middlebury College?
Well, I fell in love with Vermont, and as I write, one Vermonter in particular. I had become head of the state Young Republicans here. I felt more a part of the community in Middlebury than I did where I'd grown up. I suppose there might have been some political calculus there that Massachusetts wasn't terribly Republican, and at that time, Vermont was. But I'd gotten to know a lot of interesting people here. Dick Snelling, for example, I met when I was in college. He was a member of the Republican State Committee from Chittenden County. He had been a legislator some years before and, of course, was planning to come back not too long after that. And I met Madeline Harwood, who was a state senator and Republican National Committeeman, later a candidate for Congress. And I became more familiar with and comfortable with the people and issues of Vermont.
We're talking today with former Governor Jim Douglas. In his new autobiography, The Vermont Way, he details his life as a public servant in Vermont, from his early days as a state representative right out of college to the 2000s when he served four terms as governor. If you have a question for him about what makes him tick or what ticked him off, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Governor Douglas, you offer some personal evidence of your political convictions in this book. For example, as evidence of your thriftiness, you offer the anecdote that when it came time to have your first child, Matt, you and your wife, Dorothy, waited in the parking lot at Porter Hospital in Middlebury until right after midnight because you didn't want to have to pay for another day.
Well, that's right. Obviously, we had a pretty good sense that the delivery wasn't going to come for some time, and it didn't for another 7 or 8 hours. But, I was thrifty and am thrifty in my personal affairs, and I tried to be as thrifty as I could with Vermonters' money, too.
And Dorothy was on board with that?
Well, I guess she understood what she was getting into. You know, there are a lot of political marriages that aren't successful, but I think one of the secrets to mine is that I had already been in the legislature for several years before we were married, and I think it's been very helpful that she knew, at least at a beginning level, what she was getting into, and it's worked very well. She's been a great partner.
You point out in the book it was a fairly fast courtship, I think just 6 months, right, before you proposed to her.
That's true. That's true. I was looking around town for all of the relationships that someone needs in a new community, a physician, a dentist, and she was working in a local dental office. And as I write in the book, it was love at first bite.
You served as several terms as a representative, as you mentioned, before leaving to enter the administration of Governor Dick Snelling. And you were then elected Secretary of State and State Treasurer before becoming governor. Those posts certainly gave you some name recognition in the state, but can you talk a little bit about how they also gave you ideas about the kind of politician that you wanted to be then and when you transitioned into the state's top office later?
My predecessor as Secretary of State was Jim Guest, who went on to become the publisher of Consumer Union, and his work in Montpelier was very consistent with his work at the publication. He wanted to be sure that the office was open and accessible, that Vermonters had access to information they needed, whether it was participation at town meeting or getting a license to do business in the state or whatever it might be. And so I continued that theme and enhanced it. I published a wide variety of pamphlets and other newsletters, publications of various kinds to better connect people with their government. And I became quite known as someone who is accessible. My deputy, Paul Gillis, who was a great partner in those years, and I would stay very late on election night or town meeting night. We were ready to answer whatever questions Vermonters had. And in fact, as I relate, there was a time when a town meeting was actually recessed so that someone could call us in the Secretary of State's office to get some procedural advice. So I realized that, as our state constitution says, government officials are at all times accountable to the people. And I took that very seriously when I was Secretary of State. In the Treasurer's office, I had two major goals. One was to continue my commitment to integrity and transparency in government. It's a tremendous responsibility. There are a lot of pressures on the Treasurer with lots of vendors seeking contracts with the state for lucrative fees. And so in my first year, I asked the legislature, and it agreed, to pass a law saying that candidates for state treasurer cannot accept contributions from anyone who seeks to do business with the office, and that any gift or gratuity from those vendors was prohibited. Secondly, as a fiduciary, I wanted to be sure that I superintended the public dollars as best I could. The treasurer is responsible for several billion dollars, with a B, over the course of a year. Retirement funds, other trust funds, the operating cash of state government, bond proceeds. And so I assembled a good team. Mike Smith, my deputy treasurer, Marie Duquette, an investment director who came to us from managing the endowment at Boston University, and had a tremendous commitment to ensuring that those dollars were well stewarded and well accounted for.
Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon, Governor.
Hi, sir.
I am curious, since Vermont as a state seems to got things done, do you have any advice for our folks in Washington to start to get things done?
Well, actually, I do offer a little advice in the book. I don't know, Jane, if I should tell them over the air. We want them to go buy it. But I have a couple of suggestions. There has to be more collegiality. I cite Senator Ralph Flanders, who served Vermont from 1947 to 59 and wrote a memoir after he left the U.S. Senate. Senator Flanders was an engineer from Springfield, not very photogenic fellow, but a brilliant guy. And he talked in his memoir about how in the 50s in Washington, everything was bipartisan. The U.S. Senate in the 50s was fairly evenly split during most of that decade. And he said, we wouldn't get anything done around here if we didn't have support from folks on both sides of the aisle. Well, fast forward a half century, and what do we see down there now? We see things passing on straight party line votes or not passing because of the supermajority rule. And I think that's a shame. Senator Snow from Maine wrote a memoir recently, too. As you can see, Jane, I read a lot of memoirs before writing my own.
Yes, in fact, you said you read each Vermont governor who had written a memoir. You read those before you wrote yours.
Exactly right. And Senator Snow says we've got to change the attitude there. There has to be not only a willingness to compromise, but a reward for doing so. And in the end, we get the government we choose, and the American people, I think, have to demand more comity, that's I-T-Y, from their elected officials. I offer one specific suggestion that I think would be more helpful in Washington, and that is to change the way congressional districts are drawn. It doesn't apply to Vermont, of course, because we only have one and aren't likely to have a second again in our lifetime, but in many districts, they're gerrymandered. So incumbents are protected. One party gets an advantage over the other. And as a result, there's no centrism. Someone once said that we're a 50-50 country, but the congressional districts are 90-10. In fact, a lot of people running for re-election in the Congress are challenged by the extreme of their party, whether the right or the left. Well, I think we need more districts that are balanced and centrist, and that will yield more elected officials who are. And that means the districting process has to be different. It has to be nonpartisan, it has to be independent, and not done by the politicians who benefit from it.
When you were in the state legislature, you were on the committee that deals with districting and redistricting in Vermont. And it's not so much a districting or redistricting question here, but you do lament in the book that there's such a strong Democratic side of things in the legislature right now, so many Democrats, that it is, in fact, in essence, one-party rule. And you really don't like that. But as we've just seen today, as the results of the primary were certified, your party, the Republican Party, hasn't put up necessarily candidates in the statewide races. They've been concentrating on some of the legislative races, but there is a majority of Democrats in the legislature, and the Republicans aren't putting up statewide candidates. So what do you think about Vermont's politics when it comes to partisanship?
Well, it's sort of the reverse of what we had for a century when the Republican Party was dominant until the 1960s or 70s. We were a one-party state, 109 years of Republican governors consecutively. And even when I started in Montpelier in the 70s, Republicans were pretty dominant, even though we had a Democratic governor, Tom Salmon, at the time. I don't think dominance to that degree by the Republican Party was good for the state either. I think it's best when different ideas come from different points of view and are put in the cauldron of legislation and issues are debated and compromises reached. And now we've gone to the other extreme. You're right, Jane, that the Republican Party in Vermont hasn't fielded a strong enough or complete enough slate of candidates, and that, reflects the futility that many party leaders see in challenging some of these entrenched incumbents, many of whom have substantial war chests. But I think things are better when they're more balanced. I often said when the Democrats had huge majorities during my time in office that I didn't really yearn for Republican majorities, but just more balance. So I hope voters will keep that in mind in future years.
If you're hoping for more balance, though, is that just the fact that there isn't more balance? Is that a reflection of the minds of voters in Vermont and who they want in power?
Yes, and that's another important point that I mentioned in the book. There's a theory that some Harvard researchers came up with a few years ago called ideological transmigration. What that means is that people now increasingly want to live near people who think as they do. And so people are self-selecting where they live. A lot of more liberal people are moving to Vermont. A lot of conservative people are moving out of Vermont. And so we're becoming bluer in Vermont, and other states are becoming redder. And I don't think that's a good trend. A Pew Charitable Trust poll recently said that America is more polarized than it has ever been before based on its research from an ideological standpoint. So we have to think about that as well. We have to recognize that communities are stronger and more vibrant when not everybody agrees with everybody else. But sadly, your point is well taken that the legislative elections are a reflection of the population of the state.
Let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Chester. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi, Governor Douglas. Great to hear you on the radio today. We met a couple times back in Rutland County and while you were in office. And my question today is, I'm wondering what your thoughts are around Vermont's push to become more and more reliant on renewable energy, specifically to reach a goal of getting 90% of our electric power from renewable energy sources by year 2050.
Tim, thanks for the call. Governor Douglas?
Well, it's a laudable goal. We had goals when I was in office to achieve more reliance on renewables. The New England governors and Eastern Canadian premiers adopted goals of that kind as well. And we do pretty well compared to other places. We get a large amount of our power from Hydro-Québec, which is a renewable resource, and increasingly smaller renewable projects are underway here as well. But we can't over-rely on renewables that are not reliable. And what I mean is that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, and we have to have a solid baseload capacity for electricity supplemented by more renewable options. And I think we can move in that direction. We also have to recognize that electricity can be expensive if it comes from these newer sources. And that's one area where we've lost some ground. Over the course of my tenure in office, we moved from having the lowest relative electric rates in New England the highest rates in New England to the lowest, but now we're creeping back up again. So I think we have to, as in our political ideology, seek the balance.
We're talking today with Jim Douglas. He served for nearly 40 years in Vermont politics and Vermont government, and we're talking to him about his new memoir, The Vermont Way. He details his life as a public servant in that book. And if you have a question for him about the time that he spent in Vermont politics or his thoughts on where we're going now, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Jim Douglas is my guest today. We're discussing the anecdotes he reveals in his new autobiography, The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. And if you have a question for him about the politics and priorities he espoused, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Governor, your book is very conversational, but it does at some times read a little bit like a laundry list of the things that you got right and others who were wrong. it's a little bit short on prescriptions and introspection. So I'm curious, are you positioning yourself for another run at something, say Patrick Leahy's seat, for example?
Heavens no. My wife has her veto pen ready to intercede on that one. No, I don't have any plans to get back in elective office. I enjoyed it for a long time, but I think it's important for folks not to stay on the stage forever, but to give other people a chance. I had the privilege, as you know, Jane, of receiving cumulatively more votes than anyone in our state's history, and I'm grateful for the continuing and tremendous support of Vermonters, but no, I'm on to other things.
So who do you imagine reading the book? As I said, it is very conversational. It's an easy read in the sense that you're sort of carried along in the story. So who are you imagining as your reader?
Well, I hope everyone will log on to thevermontway.us and order a copy. I think there are several audiences, political junkies first and foremost, perhaps, but every Vermonter could find this enjoyable and entertaining and, I hope, informative as well. I did inject a lot of anecdotes, a lot of stories along the way, but try to convey a serious message as well, and that is that when people of good faith but different persuasions come together and cooperate, find common ground, and try to move an agenda forward, they can succeed. And we have to have more of that kind of cooperation in our state today.
Let's go to Brad, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hello, Governor Douglas. I have a very brief question, and I simply wanted to ask you your opinion of how you see, and I have a concern of government just becoming too big, too centralized, and taking responsibility and accountability away from the people. And I wanted your opinion on that and your insight.
Well, I quote Abraham Lincoln in the book, who explained his view of the role of government, to which I subscribe, and that is that government should do those things that people can't do for themselves or can't do as well for themselves, but not everything. And I think we have a constant tension between those who want to expand government, to provide more services, to extract more revenue from the taxpayers of a state or a country, and those who want to limit its size and scope. I tend toward the latter, but that tension, if presented in a balanced forum of people with different points of view, can be healthy and can arrive at a good conclusion. But it's very easy for government to overregulate. You know, somebody sees a tire burning in the backyard and has to be another law, or somebody gets a bad haircut and then we have another law. So I think those in policymaking positions have to exercise restraint and remember that the purpose of government, as Lincoln so articulately put, is to do things that people can't do for themselves.
And let's go to Diana calling in from South Woodstock. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Well, I would like to ask Governor Douglas what his take is or on the single-payer system that Governor Shumlin has proposed and which is supposedly going to go into effect, or would Jim Douglas have proposed a different kind of plan to reach a similar goal?
Well, we meaning all those who've served in the governorship in Vermont, have taken a pledge not to criticize our successors. I do have some candid comments in there about legislative leaders and others, but I don't want to be specific in terms of a proposal that the current governor has advanced. But let me put it this way, Jane. I think I've articulated my views on government's role in healthcare through the years, and I was pleased at the progress we made during my time in office. Starting my first year in 2003, we launched the Blueprint for Health, something that's been cited nationally as a model for reform. It focuses on wellness, on prevention, on early intervention, on keeping people healthier in the first place and not causing the expensive interventions that cause a lot of stress and cost later. And then we launched the 2005 revisions of our Medicaid program called Global Commitment and Choices for Care. We saved a lot of money doing that. We instituted Catamount Health in 2006, and through our patient-centered medical home strategy, we have done quite well. We have, last I checked, the second lowest uninsured rate in the country. We've been deemed the healthiest state in America, I think, 5 of the last 7 years, and the state has received a lot of national recognition for its efforts during that time. If listeners wanted to look at the latest blueprint report on the health department website, they'll see that the cost curve is beginning to bend a little, and it's obviously a long-term proposition. So I think we made some real progress. We did it right during the time I was in office. We've accomplished a great deal. There are very few Vermonters who are uninsured now, and I think we were on the right track.
Governor Douglas, you say you're not going to criticize current governors and certainly the politics and policies that they're working on right now. But you do mention in the book, you talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act, and you say that you think that the mandate, the individual mandate for health insurance, was the most contentious feature. And you say you don't support it. You don't think it's a good idea. So does that suggest that you don't think that single payer is also the way to go?
Well, I'll let you or listeners make that leap, but I certainly do not believe that the individual mandate is appropriate. I think Vermonters can make their own decisions, and that goes back to the question we had earlier about the proper role of government. The Federal Affordable Care Act was a very contentious time. I write about that because I was chairman of the National Governors Association when it was considered by the Congress, and it was an eye-opener, frankly, a very unsatisfying experience to deal with that kind of partisan politics in Washington that started on a higher plane with substance and bipartisanship, but quickly devolved into a party-line vote. So I don't agree with that mandate. Mandates don't always work. We have a mandate that you have to buy auto insurance in Vermont and many other states, and yet a substantial number of drivers don't. So I don't think that's the most effective way to convince people to adhere to a policy that we want them to.
I'm talking with Jim Douglas today. He's just written an autobiography called The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. And we're looking back on his service in the state and hearing from some of you who have questions for him. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Terry who says, when it comes to weigh Jim Douglas's legacy, what will stand out most is his decision to stand in the way of full legal equality by vetoing the same-sex marriage legislation. He could have adopted an inclusive view of civil rights for all Vermonters, but instead opted to side with the voices of bigotry and, quote, separate but equal. Fortunately, and surprisingly, the legislature was able to muster enough votes to override his veto, but it will forever remain a huge black mark on Douglas's legacy. So that's Terry's perspective. Governor Douglas, how do you respond to that?
Well, that's a very difficult issue, as we all remember from 5 years ago. Strongly held views. Obviously, Terry has strong views. I think what's most important about it is that we respect different ideas, different perspectives, different positions on controversial issues like that. It's consistent with what we discussed a few minutes ago, Jane, when I talked about the need for all ideas to be in the mix, and we have to respect the fact that people will disagree, but I think that's healthy, and I think most Vermonters have moved on from that very difficult debate. I have.
When you say you've moved on, is that something then that you now, I mean, it is state policy, and federal policy is to respect state policy on this issue now, so is this something that you still oppose or not?
Well, we had full equality for same-sex couples under the civil union law, and when it came down to the marriage bill 5 years ago, there was nothing substantive there. It was simply a matter of nomenclature, and I felt it was valuable to maintain the distinction between that and traditional marriage. But as Dick Snelling said, the governor is presented with issues based on a fixed set of circumstances at a given point in time, and it's impossible to speculate how a decision might be made at another point in time. But I would just say to Terry and others, decision was made. I respect it, and we should focus on what's really important, and that is ensuring that every Vermonter, regardless of sexual orientation or other matter, has the kind of hope and opportunity that we want for everybody in our state.
Governor, you've said that serving as a wartime governor was perhaps the biggest surprise to you in your role in your 8 years. Why was that surprising, and what in particular?
Well, Vermont, as you know, had the greatest casualty rate of any state. We lost more of our soldiers and airmen per capita in Iraq and Afghanistan than anybody else. And I don't know that I would have anticipated that degree of sacrifice when I took office in 2003. Our first war casualties came within a few months of that time and, of course, increased over the subsequent years. I had two opportunities to visit our troops in their combat theaters in the Middle East, and I'm so proud of the men and women of our National Guard who stepped forward and served our country. When they joined the Guard, I don't think they expected to be deployed. They probably expected more training and domestic responsibilities, but they answered the call, and for that we'll always be grateful. Attending dozens of funerals, comforting so many families, seeing the impact on not only the families but the schools, the workplaces, the communities of our state was quite powerful. And my gratitude is tempered by the sense of loss and grief that will be with me forever, and I'm sure with many people across our state.
One of the other things that you write about in the book is domestic emergency preparedness, and you spent some time as the governor making sure that the state was ready for all kinds of disasters. You worked hard with Vermont Emergency Management to make sure that the state was in a better position when you left it than when you started as governor. But it was basically then your Vermont Emergency Management, your emergency systems that were in place when Irene hit. So do you think the state was as well prepared as you thought it would be?
Well, it's hard to anticipate the severity of any natural disaster. I remember someone asking me late in my tenure, are we prepared for anything? And I said, well, I think we are. I think we're pretty well prepared for any kind of hazard that I can contemplate. And then the questioner asked, well, are we prepared for the unimaginable? I said, oh, well, maybe not in that case. But Irene was perhaps close to that in the minds of some Vermonters. It was a devastating episode that was more than we had anticipated based on the weather reports that were coming in earlier that week. But I feel good about the preparedness. I think we made real progress between 2004, when we had a survey done by FEMA, and 2010, when we had a follow-up survey done. We were ranked much higher in terms of our preparedness. We had a lot of simulated crises that we conducted with emergency management officials and with the health department, with federal agencies, and even with our neighbors in Quebec. So I think we made real progress in preparedness during those 6 years.
Nonetheless, when Irene hit, we saw state offices inundated. We saw Vermont Emergency Management had to leave its offices because it couldn't operate where it was. You know, it was a 100-year flood, but I'm not sure it was unimaginable.
No, I think you're right. In fact, there was some debate during my tenure as to whether we should have located some of the facilities there that were rebuilt during those years on the floodplain in Waterbury, and we can certainly revisit them, but they're stronger than they were, and I think whether they should be rebuilt there now, I guess, is a decision that's been made, but there may be another point of view.
Governor Douglas, you mentioned earlier in the program that your wife Dorothy has the veto pen ready if you said you were going to run for something else again. But what's next for you, or what's on the horizon for you?
Well, I'm enjoying a different pace now. Some teaching at Middlebury College, my alma mater, some service on company boards, work with a group in Washington called the Bipartisan Policy Center. We talked a lot about the lack of that in Washington, and some former colleagues and I are interacting with some of the former governors in Congress and others to try to get them to work together, and I think we're seeing a little progress on that front. So I think things are just fine.
Jim Douglas's new autobiography is called The Vermont Way, A Republican Governor Leads America's Most Liberal State. He'll be giving a reading and signing copies tomorrow at 2 p.m. in a public event at the University of Vermont. Governor Douglas, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jane.
Coming up, we'll get an update on some of the research entomologists in the state have been conducting into mosquito-borne illnesses. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All the rain we've had this summer has been great for gardeners, but it's also been good news for the species of mosquitoes that like to breed in artificial containers, the little pools created in your drain spouts, bird baths, and garbage can lids. Some of those are mosquitoes that carry diseases we worry about, like West Nile and Eastern equine encephalitis, also known as Triple E. Alan Graham is the Vermont State entomologist, and he joins us now to tell us about this year's mosquito season. Alan, nice to have you back.
Well, thank you, Jane. Glad to be back.
So I mentioned that some of the mosquitoes that really enjoyed this summer were the ones that like to breed in tiny little pools. So those are different from, what, floodplain mosquitoes, right?
Well, we have floodplain species of mosquitoes. We have some that actually just have a single generation each year, and some that have ongoing generations. That's what we see in artificial containers, buckets of water, bird baths, horse troughs, things like that. And that's why the important announcements from the Vermont Department of Health suggest, get rid of artificial containers, standing water around your house. This is a good year for doing that.
Well, given that this was a good breeding year for those types of mosquitoes, and some of them are ones that carry diseases, did you find a higher incidence of some of those mosquito-borne illnesses in the state?
No, we haven't found it. I wouldn't say that we found a higher incidence. We are reporting West Nile virus cases, but that's because we're looking in a lot more areas. We assume that West Nile virus is here in the state and is probably going to be present each year. It just depends on where we look, and we've been able to look at a lot more places this year.
You found West Nile virus in 7 mosquito batches. You found them in Brattleboro, Putney, Newbury, St. Albans, several in Rockingham. So you think that this is mostly due to the fact that you're surveying more rather than a higher incidence?
I think so, although we haven't been looking at mosquitoes for a long period of time compared with other state programs. But this probably is a pretty good year for West Nile virus, and it appears to be mostly focused over in the Connecticut Valley, although we did have an early season report up in St. Albans back on July 29th.
And that report in St. Albans, is that farther north than you're typically accustomed to seeing West Nile?
No, it should be any possible area in Vermont. It would also be up in our neighbors north of us up in Canada, up in Quebec.
So there's no geographical distribution that is significant then here in the state?
No. Mosquitoes don't respect boundaries.
What about for Triple E, Eastern equine encephalitis? Is that the same? It's widespread throughout the state?
No. Triple E batches of mosquitoes have been lower this year compared with last year. And that's pretty much true with many states up and down the East Coast. The only exception might be the upper northwest part of New York, which has had some continued Triple E activity. But we have only found 3 mosquito pools. One was a very, very early season one, which was an unusual find. But other than that, we found 1 mosquito pool, and subsequent trapping at the same site hasn't found additional batches of mosquitoes testing positive, which is a good sign.
Yeah, when you say it's a good sign, is it, or is it just, that happens to be this year, but no telling what happens next year?
This is a disease. Triple E is a disease that we can't really predict what's going to happen from one year to the next. It's, in many cases, a rare disease and mysterious disease because it can disappear for several years and then reappear. And scientists don't quite know why that is.
You mentioned that there was an early batch found, early Triple E, in Grand Isle. That was in June, I think. So, and the fact that that was early in the season, that's what's surprising about that. So does that give you any additional insight into perhaps what might happen with this disease?
We just don't know enough about it to predict anything from that. It does make me very curious, because this is we found it in a different species of mosquito, one that we're actually monitoring throughout the season and has done quite well this season, incidentally. But it's one that feeds primarily on mammals, so to find it in very early in the season is kind of intriguing, although this species is also known to feed on reptiles and birds.
And I want to clarify, I keep using the word case, which is probably not the right nomenclature, because when we're talking about finding Tripoli or finding West Nile, you're finding them in mosquitoes, and Tripoli has been found in horses before, but we're not, in this case, necessarily talking about cases in humans.
No, we have found no cases in humans or any veterinarian cases this year, and that's also a very good sign, but we still tell people to take precautions.
Do people still need to take precautions? We're nearing the end, thankfully, for many people, of mosquito season.
I would say it's still very important to take precautions, certainly through September. Once we get those heavy frosts in October and our tomatoes are gone, then we can relax. But this is still very much a season where mosquitoes, if they do have the virus, could transmit it to humans and or horses.
So repellent, long clothing, anything else?
I would just say use personal protection the best you can. And if you don't need to be out at night, don't. But certainly use personal protection whenever you're out hiking or enjoying the outside.
Alan Graham is the Vermont State entomologist. He's been updating us on concerns about mosquito-borne illness and what's been happening with mosquito testing in the state as we gratefully wrap up the mosquito season in this region. Although, Alan, I don't mean to denigrate the lofty mosquito. Thank you very much for speaking with us. I appreciate your time.
Glad to do it, Jane. Thanks.
Finally today, it's time for some of your notes to the program. Producer Sage Van Wing joins me to read some of your comments from recent programs. But first, an update on a recent interview.
Hey, Jane. A few weeks ago, we interviewed Bethany Bosch of Wallingford about her lifelong goal of swimming across the English Channel. She was preparing to leave for England after training and preparation that took a couple of years.
Bosch told us that she would only have a window of a couple of days to make the attempt, and that was based on the availability of the boat captain that she had hired to escort her across the open water from England to France, and it all depended on weather and conditions.
Well, everything fell into place. Bosch got into the water this past Saturday and finished 17 hours and 39 minutes later in the early hours of Sunday morning.
We are saying a huge, enormous congratulations to Bethany on that achievement.
Indeed. Moving on to your messages, last week we got a deeper understanding of ALS, the fatal neurological disease that has had a high profile this summer thanks to the ubiquitous Ice Bucket Challenge.
One listener wrote in response to our discussion that fundraising isn't the only way to help families dealing with ALS. Molly in Weston says, "My mother passed away from ALS 2 years ago. I want to encourage you to consider donating time in addition to or instead of money. A few hours per month, even per year, can make the difference in a caregiver's life, thereby enhancing the care they may give to their loved one. Do some dishes, wash someone's hair, play a game, paint nails, rub shoulders, watch a movie together, gossip, or just sit in silence. Give the person room to feel like someone other than, quote, a sick person."
On Friday, Congressman Peter Welch joined us to talk foreign policy. He discussed military decisions the U.S. needs to make in regard to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, as well as the war that is emerging between Russia and Ukraine.
Sylvia in Lindenville wrote, "Because Vladimir Putin is concentrating so much on Ukraine now, maybe it's the right time for the United States to take action in Syria. We were on the brink of it before and then took the route to remove chemical weapons instead because Russia supported that. But maybe Putin's preoccupation with Ukraine gives the United States an opportunity to take quick, targeted military action in Syria."
Marion Shelburne sees it differently. She wrote, "I'm concerned about the increased American action in this war against ISIS for two fundamental reasons. Crossing over into Syria with military action is violating an international border. just when we are condemning Russia for doing just that in Ukraine.
And secondly, she says we should have learned from Iraq and Afghanistan that quelling one rebel tribal group can only lead to another rising to take its place. While American military action could reduce the impact of ISIS, only the local governments can determine what the long-term value would be. That leaves us fighting a war in which we have little say on what happens after victory might be achieved.
We want to hear your feedback on Vermont Edition. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net.
Or connect with us on social media. We are on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition. Sage, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jane.
All right, that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, we're going to give and get advice to new college students. There are a lot of bewildered freshmen wandering around on campuses right now. So what's the one piece of advice you wish someone had given to you before you started your first year of college? We'll gather real-world tips for college students, both academic and social, tomorrow on the program. Send your advice to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for the discussion tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Mary Carol Meganzini. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.